So I'd like to welcome Peniel Rajkumar speaking today on religion, violence, and the call to peacemaking. Thank you so much, Peniel.
Thank you. One of the questions that I had, or one of the challenges that I wrestled with when I was trying to prepare for this forum, which I understand is about sharing about our work, was whether I should wear my work clothes, or so to speak, whether I should wear my work on my sleeve. But then I decided against it because that would be not something which would cater to most of your aesthetic tastes. So if I had to wear my work on my sleeve, it would look something like this. Yes. So I know, I don't know how many of you have seen this before, but this is the famous British Christmas interfaith jumper. It is an interreligious jumper, if you can see it. It's got the symbols of several religious communities. And my work with the WCC is as program executive for interreligious dialogue and cooperation. And let me assure you that I don't go to work with this jumper every day. So, but this jumper does convey something. It conveys the simple fact that the world, if you may draw your attention to the screen, that the world has gone irreversibly interfaith, if I have to use the phrase of the Harvard academic Wilfred Cantle Smith. The world now has really gone irreversibly interfaith. We do not have pockets of religious communities in different parts of the world which are isolated from other religious communities. We have the presence of different religions across the world. And the fact that the world has gone really irreversibly interfaith has even got a market today, because we see jumpers like this being sold, which says that there is an economics behind interreligious living. And in a context like this, where we live in a context of irreversible interreligious living, we need to be, so to speak, religiously interreligious. In a religion, we take into consideration people of other faiths. But let me pause here and then say that the fact that the world has gone irreversibly interfaith comes with its own set of challenges. One of the challenges, if you look at newspapers today, is the question of religion and violence and the role of religion in peace building. And one of the things that we at the World Council of Churches have wrestled with and are wrestling with is the question whether religion is actually a problem or a promise for peace. Does religion present a problem for peace, or does religion present a promise for peace and peacemaking? And that is what I'm going to be talking to you today. Religion nowadays is often associated with violence. If you look at this cartoon on the screen, it says it probably sums up the situation of the world quite well. It says it's a God-eat-God world kit, a take on the dog-eat-dog world thing. And several philosophers like René Girard have pointed out that probably in many ways violence and the sacred are inseparable. So that is something for us to bear at the back of our minds. And the secularists have really had a field day with this association of religion and violence. We have people like Richard Dawkins, who in his The God Delusion writes that only religious faith is a strong enough force to motivate such utter madness in otherwise sane and decent people. That only religious faith is a strong enough force to motivate such utter madness in otherwise sane and decent people. And there are some people who have subtler arguments, like Karen Armstrong. Karen Armstrong says that many still believe that instinctively there is a violent essence inherent in religion, which inevitably radicalizes any conflict. Because once combatants are convinced that God is on their side, compromise becomes impossible and cruelty knows no bounds. What they say is that religion intersects with several other factors in the production of violence. Okay? And once we bring God into the picture, yes, violence becomes, compromise becomes impossible and violence becomes inevitable. And if you look at the cartoon there, it says there is war and religion in conversation, and war is telling religion, where would I be without you? Yes, the question of God and violence and religious violence probably Bob Dylan captures it well when in his song With God on Our Side from the album With God on Our Side. And he says, the reason for fighting, I never got it straight, but I learned to accept it with pride, for you don't count the dead when God's on your side. We actually have this propensity to absolve all violence when God is brought into the picture. And we seek to justify any violence when God comes into the picture. And he says, Bob Dylan, but now we got weapons of the chemical dust. If fire them, we are forced to, then fire them, we must. And you never ask questions when God's on your side. You never ask questions when God's on your side. And that is the problem when we look at religion and violence, when the name of God is invoked as an ally for our own projects against people of other faiths. That becomes a problem. And that seems to be the picture of the world as we see it now. I think it was Jonathan Swift who said a long back that there seems to be enough religion to make us hate each other, but not enough religion to make us love one another. So probably there's some truth to that, even in the 21st century. So therefore, today my topic is, if you followed it, In God's Name, with a question mark. And I borrow it from the former chief rabbi of Jonathan Sachs' book, Not in God's Name. Okay? The title of the book is Not in God's Name. And there is a quote from the book which I find interesting. And I quote, this is what Rabbi Sachs says. When religion turns men, and I don't hesitate to use the exclusive language here, when religion turns men into murderers, God weeps and says, not in my name. When religion turns men into murderers, God weeps and says, not in my name. So, and that is why I've used the title In God's Name, and then Religion, Violence, and Peace Building. But this is probably just one side of the story, the association of religion and violence. As with every story, there are two sides to each story. And we need to look at the other side of religion as well. Several people have argued that religion can contribute to peace. And we have seen evidence in the life of lived religious communities that religion does indeed contribute towards peacemaking. And my work, for example, is with communities which really have the conviction that religions can contribute to peacemaking. And therefore, it is important that we look into that side of the story too. Let me quote the words of Dr. Sam Kobia. There was a big interfaith conference that the WCC organized a few years back, quite a few years back. It was called A Critical Moment in Interreligious Dialogue. And during this conference, the former General Secretary of the WCC, Dr. Sam Kobia, had this to say. He said, if we people of faith cannot give the world hope, then the future is hopelessly bleak. We can only be effective and successful in a search for hope if we work together. Alone, one can only travel a limited distance. Together, we can go further towards restoring hope for another possible and better world in which all people may experience abundant life in dignity. There's a lot to this quote. Yes. But at the root of this quote is the fact that there is need for religious communities to work together if we have to overcome violence. And in my talk today, I want to focus on how religious communities can work together towards peacemaking, towards overcoming violence and peacemaking. And what I want to do is to point to a basic framework which we at the WCC, the Program on Interreligious Dialogue and Cooperation, have at the back of our minds as we engage in interfaith engagement. So a basic framework which guides our thinking and our actions as we think about religious communities working together to overcome violence and towards peace. So the call to peacemaking. And the basic framework that I have in mind for overcoming violence and making peace is this tripartite framework. It includes a framework of honesty, a framework of hospitality, and a framework of humility. A framework of honesty, a framework of hospitality, and a framework of humility. And I intend to run through this each of these categories one by one. So, framework of honesty. I think when it comes to religions, there is a lot of dishonesty which goes around. Especially when we come to the dialogue tables, usually there is this propensity to be defensive about our own religious tradition. We want to claim that our religion is the religion of peace and is not part of the problem. I think if religions have to really work together with one another, we need to take responsibility and see our part in the problem. So what is needed is a framework of honesty. And very often we claim that the content of religion is non-violent, and we blame human beings for engaging in violence. But according to François Houtart, this is what he says. In fact, the roots of violence can be found right back in the religions. And that is why the religions can also easily serve as vehicles for violent tendencies. If we pause and look at the Christian scriptures, we cannot but realize that, but accept that, okay, at the heart, at the center of the Christian scripture is our Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. But still, that doesn't mean that there are parts of scripture which are often invoked selectively, which really reinforce that probably violence is also part of the Lord's doing. This is part of God's project, and that is why some people in their attempts to follow God think that violence is justified. Okay, there are several difficult passages in the scriptures that we can quote, but I'm not going to do that now. So if you look at this thing, yes, framework of honesty is something that is important. The cartoon here says Christianity is a religion of peace, and that's a man who, but we've got people being killed in the name of being infidels. We've got people being killed in the course of Christian history in the name of being heretics. We've got people who are witch hunted. All this in the name of God and in the name of religion. So there is need for religions. This is not just in Christianity. There is probably this truth present in every religious tradition. If you go to Myanmar, when we see Buddhists really going against Rohingya Muslims, we realize that Buddhism, for all its aura as being a religion of non-violence, there is something deeply problematic. And this is something that we can see in every religious tradition. That, if we want to move towards peacemaking, I think we need to be honest about that. This framework of honesty that we are also part of the problem in some way is a crucial first step. Many of us who are involved in interreligious dialogue are probably familiar with this saying by Hans Kung, right? Yes, this famous series of couplets, no peace among the nations without peace among the religions, no peace among the religions without dialogue between the religions. But what we don't usually think about is the third couplet of this saying. It says, no dialogue between the religions without investigation of the foundations of the religions. There is need for different religions to come together to investigate the foundations of our religions. Okay, so that is an important thing in the framework of honesty. Let's move on. So, and a small step, and this was something also which came up in one of the interreligious encounters of the WCC, and this was a view which interestingly was put up by two Muslims. And this is what they said, Rashid Omar and Rabia Terry Harris, this is what they said. They said that in order to move towards peace, one small but important step is to recognize that all of our sacred texts and stories provide opportunities for justifying violence as well as healing. All of our sacred texts and stories display what they call ambivalence. All our sacred texts and stories provide possibilities for intolerant as well as tolerant interpretations. And therefore they said, what is needed is a reinterpretation of the narrative so that healing and a transformed relationship with the perceived enemy become integral parts of a renewed spiritual vision. So this way of engaging with the scriptures in a way which is life-affirming and peace-promoting is what is needed in the framework of honesty. And we have several good examples about how this is done, but I will not pass to reflect on that. Let's move on. There is one good example in. Let's move on to the second in the Jewish tradition about the crossing of the Red Sea. I will come to that later when we have time for questions. But let's move on. The second framework is the framework of hospitality, which is essential for religions. David Lockhart, a sociologist, a sociology of religions person, says he talks about hostility as being an ideological stance which is present in each religion, both overtly and covertly. We may not realize that, but there is hostility inbuilt in it. It is not necessarily going out and attacking the other, but it's somehow even in the subconscious. And what he says is, hostility thrives on purity of faith that sometimes even defines faithfulness as requiring hostility. Sometimes the way in which people are indoctrinated or introduced into Christianity, sometimes faithfulness is really defined as requiring some hostility. Let me explain what I mean by that. There are three features in which this happens. One is when we are taught that the other religious tradition is a threat. The second is when we perceive the other religious tradition as being erroneous. And not only that, we don't just think that the other religious tradition is wrong in its beliefs, but we also think that the error of the other is not a naive error, but it is an intentional error, so that they do it just to undermine my faith. The third feature is when the other is perceived as engaging in a deliberate undermining strategy. Okay? And coming from India, from a very traditional and a progressive religious family, I can identify with all three features. My grandparents, my parents were people whom I thought were really humane, but when it came to religion, there was something which made me suspicious of the other, which helped me to think of the other as being wrong, and therefore, and being wrong for the wrong reasons, so to put. And also, as other religions, as deliberately undermining Christianity. I don't know how you relate with these things. But this somehow produces hostility towards the other faith. It did, and it requires a lot to overcome that. And one way of overcoming that is to have a framework of hospitality. To think how we can live as companions rather than as combatants. And that is something which is important. And one way in which we move towards interfaith hospitality is to learn about the other, is through interreligious literacy. How do we learn about the other? Not through our own eyes, but through the eyes of the other. Okay? We usually bring our own framework and try to judge the other religion on the basis of it. Okay? This is my view of salvation, their view of salvation doesn't fit. Okay? My view of peace, their view of peace doesn't fit. But we need to understand the interfaith literacy is understanding the other on the basis of their own terms. And that is something that we've been doing through a program that I usually organize in Asia. It is called Yatra, which is Youth in Asia Training for Religious Amity. We usually get a group of about 30 or 35 young people together, and we try and understand and come to know of the other religion, engaging with the other religious traditions. And we've had four years of this training so far. The first was in Siem Reap in Cambodia, 2014 and 2015. Then we moved to Jakarta in 2016 and 17. And we learned a lot. And one of the things that we learned is about the role of religions in overcoming hostility. And at this point, I want to share with you a quote by Tun Chunarat, whom we met in Cambodia. If you see, he's confined to a wheelchair. His leg is gone, which means he is a victim of a landmine blast. Okay? And this is what Tun, he spoke to our group. And this is what he said. He said, as humans, we all have landmines in our hearts, but also a flower. What we need is to eliminate the landmine and let the flower bloom. And he asked a question, do you know when we let this flower bloom? And his answer was, when we love the other and learn what it means to be the other. So I think that is important. And Tun is no ordinary man. If you look at this picture, in 19, probably, if Jonathan were here, probably he would know. In 1997, he was part of the internet, he was the one who collected the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the international campaign to ban landmines. Somebody, because he mobilized a lot of people in this struggle to ban landmines, okay? And when these words came from him, it meant a lot, a victim of violence. It meant a lot about how we can overcome hostility by cultivating hospitality. Okay, so we had an opportunity to post with the Nobel Peace Prize, which is always good. Now we don't have to go far. It's available in the Ecumenical Center. So we can for a photo op, we can always go upstairs. So, and also the other thing about hospitality is to move beyond tolerance. Very often we think hospitality is tolerating the other. But tolerance is not always enough. So we do not have to think of the other as merely an unavoidable inconvenience. Or an evil that cannot be eliminated. We need to know the other, and that is why interfaith literacy as knowing the other is something which is important for the cultivating of hospitality. So let's move on to the last framework. I know I'm running out of time. So the other thing about interfaith hospitality is also to come to the defense of the religious other. Neither tolerance is today when religions or different religious communities are in threat across the world. As our Christian responsibility is actually to stand and speak up for the other religious tradition. Because very often we think that being nice to the other involves a lot of passivity and inaction. We are not the troublemakers, so we think we are on a higher pedestal than those who are creating trouble to others. But I think it is time for Christians to actually stand up in defense of the other and protect the other when the other is threatened. By religious violence and bigotry. And that is something that I want to... these are a few pictures. Muslim men protecting a Catholic church in Egypt during mass. Okay, there's things that we can learn from the other religious communities. The third framework that I mentioned is the framework of humility. And Christians, especially with our history of colonialism, have to relearn humility in the way in which we engage with other religious traditions. So what is needed is a framework which needs to understand that religious ideas have been and can very easily become the source of material oppression and violence. Okay? So the history of violence, history of colonialism says that violence is not only in acts, it is also in ideas. We can discuss a bit more about that when we have time for questions. But through different ideas, the colonial idea that other religious traditions and cultures are inferior to Christianity is something that we need to overcome. And that is why we need humility. Okay? And the framework of humility promotes and encourages authentic accompaniment. If you have to accompany other religions, we need this framework of humility. So how does this translate into practice? How does this humility translate into practice? That is what I want to talk about. There are two things at least. One is learning from the other and working with the other. So if we talk about interreligious dialogue fundamentally means I can learn from you. And in many ways, it is a dagger, that's a very, very problematic language to use for interreligious dialogue and peacemaking. A dagger pointing at the heart of absolutist religious ideology. But this is a quote that I'm using from Swidler. So it is something which rejects any absolutism on the part of religion. And that can happen only through humility. The other thing, the other challenge is that we learn to work with people of other faiths. Usually when Christians work with people of other faiths, there is this tendency to be the host always. We are the ones, we are in charge, we are the ones inviting, so we set the agenda. No, we need to overcome what is called the will to host always. A Korean theologian called Hyuk-Yong Kim, he calls this hostility, H-O-S-T hyphenated ility, which means the will to host always. And he calls this the original sin of imperialistic Christianity. Okay? The original sin of imperialistic Christianity. So, we need to give up the power of always being the organizers, of always being the ones who set the agenda, and need to learn what is it that the others also want. How is it that the others can also host us? How we can be guests at their tables and collaborate in their acts for in their acts of justice and peace, rather than saying, this is my program, why don't you come be part of it? We need to actively search how we can be part of the other's program. So as somebody said, the first act of interfaith collaboration, paradoxically, may not be to act, but to learn from the other. So these are essential for a framework of humility. So this is one picture of us in Bangkok when we went there. We had this dialogue with the Buddhists. So instead of us, a lot of us, and me, both of us were involved in organizing this. So what we decided was, instead of inviting the Buddhists to our Christian Bangkok Christian guest house, we decided to go to their monastery. And that was upon their invitation. So things like that, where we make ourselves guests of the other, is probably a good way of being vulnerable and learning from the other. So the other important thing, the last thing, and I'll finish with that, is to rethink who are our partners in interreligious dialogue, okay? So who is present at the interreligious dialogue table matters. Too often, interreligious dialogue has been the privilege of the elite. There are religious leaders, there are theologians, there are academics, all of whom are established to come at the tables. But what they are completely clouded off from are the struggles of people on the ground who are working for peace and justice on a daily basis, who have been the victims of violence. So when will the voices of these victims become part of the solution? Okay, these people are overcoming violence each day. And therefore, we need to return the tables of dialogue overturn the tables of dialogue and have places for people from marginalized communities, victims of violence, so that the dialogue becomes real and it leads to peace building. And this is a picture. If you see the picture, it doesn't come out well. All those people who have been part of dialogues, for example, we see Aung San Suu Kyi there, who is now a bit controversial at this point of time. At one point of time, we would have seen her as being a model of peace and justice, but now her role is controversial, and that's the reason why I wanted to put this picture in mind. We need to rethink who our dialogue partners are in order for us to really move to peacemaking, and the time is now for this. So in other ways, we need to shape interreligious engagement from the bottom up. Get people from the bottom of the society, the margins, the victims of violence, the survivors of violence, and proceed towards a path of peacemaking. Okay? So in conclusion, I just want to, but let's not make the mistake of thinking that interreligious dialogue is only to solve problems of the world. When we use this framework of honesty, when we use the framework of hospitality, when we use the framework of humility, we are not only responding to isolated events of violence. We are making interreligious dialogue something else. And that's why I want to end with this quote, which says that interfaith cooperation is not an emergency room treatment. It is not an emergency room service. It is not a quick fix. Interfaith dialogue is never a quick fix. Rather, it is a public health program where through prophylactic medicine and vaccines, a whole culture of tolerance and resistance to violence is built up. So that is what we are involved in. Not short-term solutions to isolated problems, but a long-term involvement which will transform lives, which will transform communities, so that we can move forward to a world which is free of violence and where peace reigns. Thank you.